from WHYY in Philadelphia. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the daughter of Marlena Dietrich, we talk with Maria Riva about her legendary mother. Riva describes her mother as a romantic, self-absorbed queen who surrounded herself with people who worshipped her. Riva's written a memoir based on her mother's letters and diaries. Also, we meet actor Willem Dafoe. He's played some of the baddest bad guys on film in movies like To Live and Die in L.A. and Streets of Fire. He also played Jesus in Martin Scorsese's controversial film The Last Temptation of Christ. He's currently starring in Body of Evidence with Madonna. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the season finale of I'll Fly Away on NBC. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate has begun taking the first of at least two votes on the issue of homosexuals in the military. Republicans hope to attach it to the family leave bill already approved by the House. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Senators are debating a non-binding resolution approving President Clinton's decision last week to call for hearings and an immediate halt to the military's questioning of new recruits about their sexual orientation. Republicans pushed for the vote. Indiana Republican Dan Coats said the change in policy will reduce the nation's ability to field an effective military force. New Hampshire Republican Robert Smith accused the president of declaring war on the military. However, Illinois Democrat Carol Mosley Braun said it was an issue of individual rights.
This much we can say with absolute certainty. The military has no more of a rational basis for banning gays and lesbians in 1993 than it did for segregating African Americans in 1943.
The Senate is expected to end its debate this evening and then approve the family leave bill. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
President Clinton said today that he'll send Secretary of State Warren Christopher to the Middle East soon to try to revive the Arab-Israeli peace talks. The president said the trip will demonstrate his administration's commitment to the peace process and warned that the moment for peacemaking could easily slip away. Christopher is expected in Israel on February 17th after holding talks with Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, and the Palestinians. The peace talks have been endangered by the Arab-Israeli dispute over some 400 Palestinians who were expelled by Israel in December. The Turkish government announced the arrest today of 19 members of an Islamic fundamentalist group trained in Iran following the assassination of a prominent Turkish journalist. The car bomb attack, which occurred less than 2 weeks ago, brought thousands of Turks to the streets. NPR's Deborah Amos has this report from Ankara.
The Turkish Interior Minister announced the arrest today as pressure mounted on the government to find the killers of a writer known for his investigative journalism as well as his stand against Islamic fundamentalism. The government minister said the alleged assassins had links with Iran and that three of its leaders were believed to have taken refuge there. He named a training base located between Tehran and the Iranian city of Qum. However, Turkey has stopped short of directly accusing the Iranian government of responsibility. Iran has denied any links to the killing. Turkey's interior minister told a news conference today that the group Islamic Action had been charged with the murder of two other pro-secular Turkish writers and an Iranian dissident. There have been a number of unsolved political murders in Turkey over the past 2 years, but the most recent incident has sparked huge public protests. In Ankara, this is Deborah Amos.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 43 points today. This is NPR. An Atlanta jury found today that General Motors was responsible in the death of a Georgia teenager 3 years ago and awarded his parents $105 million in damages. The boy's death was allegedly caused by a design flaw in his GMC pickup truck, which exposed the fuel tanks to damage during a collision and caused the vehicle to burst into flame. General Motors defended its compliance with government safety tests and said the jury's verdict was based on emotional rather than scientific factors. A House subcommittee on crime and criminal justice began looking into the problem of health fraud today, hearing estimates that as much as $80 billion a year is lost to fraudulent medical schemes. NPR's Carol Ann Clark has more.
The panel heard stories of unneeded tests and procedures and kickback arrangements that benefit everyone but the patient. Larry Morey, a deputy inspector general for the Department of Health and Human Services, told the subcommittee that convictions for health care fraud are up, but that his office is overwhelmed by the scope of the problem and a lack of resources to combat it.
For example, we have about 1 million providers in the Medicare area alone, and that would equate to one street agent for every 8,700 healthcare providers out there. There's no way that we can keep up with this.
Janet Scheichels with the General Accounting Office says in addition to more money, laws must also be changed which prevent insurers from sharing information on fraud cases. Without this, she says it's too easy for fraudulent operators to simply move on to the next victim. I'm Carol Ann Clark in Washington.
The House has approved a bill that would require states to make it easier for citizens to register to vote. The so-called Motor Voter Bill would permit people to register at state motor vehicle departments or other state agencies, including welfare offices. The measure passed on a largely party-line vote of 256 to 160. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen. For 68 years, Maria Riva has been known as the daughter of Marlene Dietrich. Every child has to live down their parents' reputation, but when your mother is the very definition of celebrity, it's impossible to have a typical or normal childhood. Riva has just written a book about her mother called simply Marlene Dietrich. The front of the book features her mother's famous face. The title of the book is hidden on the back. It's an unsentimental account of their life together, of her parents' open marriage, of her mother's many love affairs, and Riva's own struggles to come to terms with her mother's fame. Since so much was written about Dietrich during her lifetime, I asked Maria Riva why she wanted to write this book.
Well, Dietrich's autobiography was invention, and it was, as she saw, her own reality, which, of course, Dietrich was magnificent in creating her own reality. And when you're that famous and that much of a legend, the world believes whatever you say. That's one of the things about being very famous, unfortunately, in our civilization, that everything you say is believed as rote. What I wanted to do was to say many things, but also I think that it's a fascinating time. This is a woman who grew up in Germany before the First World War, lived through the First World War as a German, and then the Sodom and Gomorrah of Berlin of the 20s, which is not very well known anymore, where cross-dressing was accepted and it was a daily thing to be seen on the streets and nobody was shocked by it. And then Dietrich brought that quality of wearing men's trousers to Hollywood, to the puritanical America of the 30s and the really great years of Hollywood, you know, of the 30s. And then you have the Second World War and the luxury before that war and the lives after. I'm fascinated by the history of this woman's life much more than I am about the fact that she's my mother.
Could you have written this book while she was alive?
I did write it while she was alive.
Well, could it have been published while she was alive?
I never wanted it to be published. That was my condition to my publishers. I do not feel that if someone has never faced reality and has lived in their own manufacture all their lives, if you can help them with the truth, then you should. But if you can no longer help them, and if it doesn't serve any purpose that is positive, why put them through it?
So you had this written and you waited for your mother to die?
That's right. She knew that, though.
She apparently was outraged that you were writing this book and actually threatened to sue you.
Not at all. What papers have you been
well,
reading?
Well, I wish I had it at my fingertips. I did read that she was threatening Knopf.
No, that was not it. She wasn't even threatening Knopf. My mother told me to write this book because she knew that people would be coming, as these are her words, coming out of the woodwork, and she used some rather foul language describing these gentlemen or ladies that would be coming out of the woodwork. And she said, everybody thinks they know me, even if they've talked to me for 5 minutes on the phone or have never even met me. I want you to write it. And for years now, she has been sending me material, always marked for your book, for your book. Mm. And also, she gave me all of her diaries, not only her childhood diaries, but her later ones.
Well, you mentioned the fact that she was very good at making her own reality. in reading through her letters and in reading through her diaries, is this the truth, or is this just what she wanted others to think about her? And, well, and how, as her, in a sense, her biographer, how did you figure out what was truthful?
By having lived with her for 64 years continually. Don't forget, I never went to school. I never had a normal kind of life. That's why the book's so thick, and I always I always apologize and tell them, don't get scared, don't get scared. My daughter-in-law says, oh, it's an easy read, Mom. But it's a fascinating time and a fascinating woman, and I think that what I was always so interested was that I always observed her, you see. I never had anything else to do. I didn't have friends or homework or things that would, you know, take up your time and take up your memories. I just had Dietrich. We all just had Dietrich. Even Dietrich only had Dietrich because she thought of herself in the third person. We were all there to serve the legend. The recreation of the legend, the creation of the legend, the polishing of the legend. It was everyone's job to serve that magnificent myth, that legend up there on that screen.
Have you always called your mother Dietrich?
Oh, when I refer to her as a biographer, I think of her as Dietrich. When I think of her professionally, I think of her as Dietrich, just as she did. She used to say, Dietrich wouldn't wear that hat. No, that's not a Dietrich pair of shoes. We're not going to order that. No, Dietrich, what would Dietrich now do? She was the one who led the Dietrich brigade.
Reading her diaries, which are included in this book, at the age of 16, 17, when she's still a teenager, she seemed very aware and confident of her beauty. Would you say that she always felt that way, maybe until later on in her life, but as a young child growing up with Marlene Dietrich, would you say that she was always aware of her beauty?
Yeah, oh, you know, that's why I included the diaries. Of course, there are many more, but isn't it wonderful that this is a woman, really, you can read her diaries as a young girl of 13, and you can read the diaries later in the book when she is already in her 60s and 70s. And it's the same woman. Most people change over a period in their lives. They grow with the time, and something changes in their character. But Dietrich never did. She was exactly the same romantic, self-absorbed. The world was there for her. She was the most important thing in it, and her feelings were the most important things in the world. It's amazing to me how somebody can go, you know, make that arc from 13 to 70 without changing. Yes, I think that she always felt different. She always felt that she was special. Maybe not special because she was the most beautiful, but special because she knew she was different and special.
How much time did she spend then working on her appearance before she left the house? And you say even before she would get a role in Hollywood, she would diet like crazy, but her diet was terrible.
Well, Dietrich didn't know what the diet was, you know. How she ever escaped beriberi and malnutrition all those years, because that was the years before vitamin pills, you know. You see, there again, you can't blame Dietrich for really believing that she was immortal. Not only did the world say that she was an immortal legend, but her body told her that she must be immortal, because how can you live on sauerkraut and pickles and cold frankfurters and Epsom salts and look as beautiful as that? I mean, nobody could do this.
That was her diet?
That was her diet. And she ate like a horse when she wasn't working, like a truck driver, like a German truck driver, you know, potatoes and gravy and sausages, you know. And she would shovel it down. It was the only time that I ever saw my mother lose this Prussian aristocrat quality of hers, you know, was when she was eating. She'd shovel it in, you know. And then the moment work was announced, you know, pre-production, when you went into the designing of costumes, that was the cutoff point. And she would say, I'm fat. You know, she hated the word fat. And she always said it with such an ugly tone, you know, you sort of cringe, because if you thought you were fat or you felt fat, you immediately thought that you were the dregs of the earth if you were fat, you know. Because she said it with such venom and hatred. And she said, I'm fat. and out would come the Epsom salts into the water in these beakers of Epsom salt. She would drink this stuff, you know, and her skin was beautiful, never a pimple, you know, the hair was glossy, the eyes were magnificent. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Were you ever fat?
Oh, I was always fat. But, you know, if you live with perfection, you're bound to feel imperfect. That's a normal thing. That's not just me.
Did your mother say things about your weight?
Oh, by inference. She wasn't Joan Crawford, you know. She she was much more subtle and elegant. She sort of let you pick up vibes like that. You know, she would say peasants have thick ankles as she pulled the laces of my shoes very, very tight in order to make my ankles appear a little thinner, you know, in those high-top shoes children wear in those days anyway.
If that was my mother, and I'm sitting here imagining that she could do almost anything to her body and not have to pay the consequences for it, I would feel so resentful. Did you?
Oh, no. You have to have a certain feeling of yourself and a certain vanity to feel resentful when somebody else is prettier than you. We didn't really have that. We were, when I say we, it's strange that I say we, but everyone in the service of Dietrich was so overpowered by this this practically hysterical, fanatical dedication to the beauty and to the legend that we were all fabricating and that we were all polishing and establishing, that one never thought of oneself in conjunction with it. I mean, you really don't compare yourself to a god.
And that's how you felt, that she was the god?
Well, yes, and you can't really blame her for thinking it or for us being influenced by it, because the world also thought she was. And one of the things I wanted to say with this book that's beyond the entertainment value of it, I hope, and that is that legends are great, myths are wonderful, movie stars certainly have a place in our society. But when we make them into a divinity, it becomes dangerous. I think man-made gods are very dangerous.
Dangerous for the god, or dangerous for their children?
I think dangerous for the society in which they suddenly have this power. We have to be very careful. It makes Hitlers, and it makes tragedies in smaller ways. And whenever I get very angry or annoyed by questions and things about the book or my mother, even before I wrote the book, I used to say, come on, kids, we're talking about a movie star, a beautiful, magnificent, legendary movie star. But it's not Mother Teresa.
My guest is Maria Riva, the only child of Marlene Dietrich. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Maria Riva, and we're talking about a book that she's written about her mother. Her mother was Marlene Dietrich, and Maria Riva's book is called Marlene Dietrich. Your mother had many lovers, and yet, as you write about her, she claims to really have hated sex and sort of had to endure the sex. What was it that she wanted from her lovers, if not sex?
Adulation, admiration, devotion. Lyrical, a romance. That's all that Dietrich ever wanted.
She's quoted as saying, when asked if she preferred men or women, she said, women are better, but you can't live with a woman. And, of course, the words used now is whether she was a lesbian or not, and I'm not even sure if that's a correct way to describe her sexuality. Was she conflicted at all about her interest in men and women?
Oh, no, not at all. But then again, you have to go back to a time that was long before you were born, and that was the conditions in Germany in the 1920s where she really became she made that transition into governing and controlling her own existence, both sexually and professionally. was a time when this was absolutely acceptable, as it has always been much more in Europe and certainly in Germany than it has been ever in America. She saw no difference. Being in love was being in love. Dietrich could be in love with a piece of cake, a flower, a piece of music, a woman or a man, on equal basis, with equal intensity. And she never made, it never disturbed her or even entered her consciousness to decide which was better. And that quote that you have is one of those charming witticisms of Dietrich that are thrown out to reporters when she and they needed a clever line.
Were you aware as a young child that most people didn't live this way?
No, you know, because I didn't know any other children. And if you don't go to school, you never meet any other kids who then tell you about their life, or you never even get invited to a birthday party and meet another mother and father, another household. I thought all kids were like I was. And doesn't everybody have a mother that falls in love every 5 minutes with something? You know, I thought that was absolutely normal. And I didn't suffer under it because I had no comparison to it, you see. I had nothing to compare it to.
But you really didn't know what the outside world was like?
Not at all, no. I lived I was sort of cloned to my mother's hip. We would get up in the morning at 4:30, 5 a.m. in the morning, and she would wash her hair, and we'd get into the limousine with the chauffeur, and the Rolls Royce would take us to the studio. The only home that, for me, that I can remember is Paramount Studio. I had my own private Disneyland.
What was it like there for you?
Oh, it was great. There's nothing like a studio. It's really Disneyland. I mean, in those days of Paramount, it was a fabulous time. I mean, the Marx Brothers were on the lot, and they used to figure out routines while they were walking from their dressing room to the set or the commissary. And you would see them and W.C. Fields and Mae West and later on, and there was Claudette Colbert and all the Cecil B. DeMille films, and then later on there was Clark Gable, Lombard. We had loan outs from other studios, and they would come to Paramount. I mean, it was a wonderful time. I just never had enough time because I was always running to do something for my mother. But occasionally, when my mother was busy behind the locked door of the dressing room, then I was allowed to, you know, find my own way, and I would go to the commissary and eat and then go and sneak onto other sets. It was great.
So you were an observer?
Mm-hmm. I think I've been an observer. But then a lot of single children are, I think.
Let me ask you about an incident. You said that you were sexually abused by your nanny?
Mm-hmm. My governess, yeah.
What happened?
Well, as I wrote in the book, it's, one can be raped by many things and by many people. And I was put in an apartment that was unsupervised by anyone with a very masculine, visually masculine woman who only helped herself to what had been placed before her, and I happened to have been the meal.
How do you think that experience affected you, the fact that as you say, you were this meal, but helpless to do anything about it?
Wouldn't have been believed? As I say in the book, I was really, I did not know what was happening, that what was happening to me had a name. It was only later that I knew it was rape. But I think that I was trained for it. If you have always been trained to be subservient, always be there, always be obedient, never open your mouth, do what you're told, you are already victimized by your circumstances and by your upbringing. To be victimized sexually is just the next step into hell. And now that I can look from a vantage point of being whole, it's easy to say probably what happened to me at that moment in my life saved me.
How do you
mean
that?
While it happened, it certainly didn't seem that way.
Saved you how?
I think that if you're taken to the brink of disaster, and in any experience, and you are made to look down into hell, and you wish to step down into it, you wish to take your own life, you go through drug addiction to the point of no return until you wish to annihilate yourself completely, not just with drugs.
And you did that?
Oh, yes, I was an alcoholic, a teenage alcoholic. But that is also a normal progression from being raped. And that's why I wanted to write it, you see, because I asked my grandchildren and my sons and my husband before writing this book, because they have to live with what I say. And I needed their permission to do what I wanted to do. And I said, if I can't write the rape correctly so that I can help somebody, maybe, to admit it, to come out, to see that it, one doesn't need to hide it and be ashamed for the rest of one's life, then I must write it, and I must write it correctly, but I must have your permission to do so, because it will not be a pretty thing to write.
What was the process then of dealing with? I mean, it sounds like you don't feel like a victim now.
Oh, no, I was very, very lucky. In my time, the drug of of my youth was alcohol, and it was not crack. It was not the chemicals that we now have out on the streets. And alcohol is just as big a drug as any other, but it gives you a little bit more time while you're destroying yourself with it, and it gives you, therefore, that chance for salvation before your mind goes and before all the nerve fibers have been rotted away by the chemicals that we have today. So in that case, I was very, very lucky that it was alcohol. In the other case, it was that I was handed a book, and also that's difficult to understand nowadays, because nowadays you can go into a bookshop and you'll see shelves and shelves and shelves of self-help books. In my day, there were no such things. The only books on psychiatry or self-analysis or analysis of any kind were in the medical libraries in schools.
So what book were you
handed? And this was the first book that was printed. It was called The Neurotic Personality of Our Time by a woman who had escaped in Nazi Germany called Karen Horney, who has since then has become a very revered analyst. And I was given the book, and somehow, and I can't tell you why, but somehow this book reached me. It was like a hand coming out to hold me and to tell me, you're not alone. I'm here to comfort you.
And after reading the book, how soon were you able to stop drinking?
Oh, it took a long time. Yeah. You know, the road to salvation is a long road. But if you find it, it's already wonderful that you're on a road at all that's taking you there.
So were you able to get sober with this book and by yourself, or did you need...
Yes, maybe it was that discipline of the Dietrich that I always have such respect for in Dietrich professionally that I inherited a bit of, but whatever it was, I kept on the road, and it led me to my husband, which was my final salvation, I think.
Marlene Dietrich, from really the age 79 on, became a recluse. Why? Why did she disappear?
I think most people believe, the normal kind of a progression that people believe that when a woman is very beautiful and she loses her beauty, she goes to pieces and locks the door and hides herself for the rest of the life because she can't stand her own decay. This would be normal, but Dietrich was never normal. Dietrich did not have any sense. She was skilled enough and a professional enough to know that if she wanted to recreate the Dietrich legend as she had done when she was 75, she could do it again at 80 or 90 even. And when I saw her the last time, which was 2 days before her death, she was just, if we had had the right wig and the same dress and the same foundation, she would have been just as beautiful. But what was with her was that she got on to the drugs and the sleeping pills and the booze, and she'd been on it for a long, long time. I covered up for her for 20 years. She was performing as an alcoholic, and nobody knew it. So this was just a progression, and to witness her self-destruction with the same dedication as she had built the legend was a terrible thing to watch.
Do you miss your mother?
No, I do not. I missed her many, 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 many years ago when I needed her. I stopped missing her a long time ago.
Maria Riva's book about her mother is called Marlene Dietrich. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with Fresh Air. Actor Willem Dafoe didn't plan on becoming a major film star. He got his start acting with the avant-garde theater The Wooster Group, which he still works with. Dafoe starred in the films Platoon, The Last Temptation of Christ, Mississippi Burning, and now Body of Evidence. Coming up, we meet actor Willem Dafoe. And TV critic David Bianculli wants NBC to give I'll Fly Away another chance. The show's season finale is this Friday, and it probably won't be coming back. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has approved a compromise with the White House on temporarily suspending a formal discharge of homosexuals from the military. The compromise had been worked out between President Clinton and Democratic congressional leaders. By voice vote a short time ago, the Senate approved the non-binding resolution that leaves changes worked out last week, including stopping recruiters from asking applicants about their sexual orientation. According to White House aides, President Clinton will support an international peace plan for Bosnia if parties involved in the fighting there are on board. White House spokeswoman Dee Dee Myers says the president is not trying to block a plan that is being resisted by Bosnian Muslims. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Presidential spokesman said in two separate briefings today that Mr. Clinton is not shying away from a leadership role in the Bosnia crisis. Clinton aide George Stephanopoulos said today the president will have a more definitive announcement on U.S. policy toward Bosnia in the near future. At the State Department today, Secretary Warren Christopher said he makes no apologies for taking the time to ask hard questions to determine whether the plan put forward by Lord David Owen, a former British Foreign Secretary, and former U.S. Secretary of State Cyrus Vance, is fair and feasible. The plan would divide Bosnia and Herzegovina into 10 semi-autonomous provinces tied together by a loose central government. Owen has accused the United States of trying to block the plan. Christopher says it's the most difficult problem he's ever grappled with. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
According to top UN officials, thousands of Muslims have been fleeing eastern Bosnia to escape continued fighting and to find food. Officials say some people are dying as they leave their homes. On Capitol Hill, the House has overwhelmingly approved a democratically sponsored motor voter bill. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The motor voter bill instructs states to allow citizens to register to vote by mail at motor vehicle offices and other state agencies, including welfare offices. It is almost identical to the one approved last year before President Bush's veto killed it. Republicans argued that the motor voter bill would allow illegal aliens to subvert the voting process and that the legislation represented another unfunded federal mandate to the states. But Representative John Lewis, a Georgia Democrat, said the bill will increase voter turnout in future elections.
I am sick and tired of hearing arguments that said that this bill is too costly. You cannot and we must not put a price tag on democracy.
10 states already have motor voter registration. The Senate is expected to take up the bill, and President Clinton has said he will sign it. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the Capitol.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 43 points to close at a new high of 3,416.76. This is NPR News. President Clinton is sending Secretary of State Warren Christopher to the Middle East later this month in a new effort to get peace talks underway again. Christopher says that he believes that Middle Eastern peace talks will resume, and his trip will to make sure that occurs. Talks have been suspended in the wake of Israel's expelling 400 Palestinians to southern Lebanon. This will be Christopher's first trip overseas as Secretary of State. He will make stops in Egypt, Israel, and Syria. In Cologne, Germany, officials say that three foreigners have been injured in what they termed a racially motivated arson attack. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
The arsonist set on fire the entrances to three adjoining houses, home to a Turkish family and to Eastern Europeans of German descent. One woman and two teenagers suffered smoke inhalation and were hospitalized. The other 20 residents were able to flee safely. Police say there is no trace of the attackers, who smeared swastikas and anti-foreigner slogans before throwing homemade firebombs. Meanwhile, in Bonn, the government ombudsman for foreigners, Schmalz Jakobsen, introduced a law in parliament that would simplify citizenship in Germany for foreigners. Schmalz Jakobsen said if foreigners had long ago been better integrated into German society, there would be fewer racial tensions today. The issue is controversial, and it is not certain the proposed law will get a majority vote in parliament. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
In Croatia, heavy fighting is reported between Serbian and Croatian forces along the coast, even as UN officials said both sides had agreed to attend peace talks. Over the last 2 weeks, Croatian forces have taken back land lost 2 years ago. And Yugoslav news reports say that thousands of people have been forced out of their homes. In Bosnia, the capital city of Sarajevo has come under heavy shelling attacks again, and both sides have reported heavy fighting along a main road. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Willem Dafoe's Bobby Peru in David Lynch's film Wild at Heart was one of the most menacing characters to ever hit the screen. Dafoe makes a good bad guy, and he's put those talents to use in the films Streets of Fire and To Live and Die in L.A. But he escaped that typecasting and went on to play a heroic soldier in Platoon, an FBI agent in Mississippi Burning, and was chosen to be Jesus in Martin Scorsese's The Last Temptation of Christ. This past summer, Dafoe played a drug dealer's aging delivery boy who began questioning his life at the age of 40 in the film Light Sleeper. Currently, Dafoe can be seen in the film Body of Evidence. Even though Dafoe is in much demand in Hollywood, he continues to be a member of the downtown New York experimental theater company, the Wooster Group, where he got his start 15 years ago. Even though he plays a wide range of characters, Dafoe says he's hesitant to know too much about a character before he begins the role.
Basically, I don't want to get ahead of myself. I don't want to see things before they're felt. I don't want to strain to make a certain impact. Theoretically, philosophically, I feel best using myself as a base and just preparing myself to begin the pretending and then really have the story work on me. And moving through the story becomes something of a meditation, and it's the things that are revealed about yourself that really fuel the inner life of the character. I think that gives you a greater stake in it, and also that'll lead you to hopefully greater truth about the character's behavior.
I've always been interested in your style of talking. You seem to choose your words very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
Does that come from growing up in the Midwest?
My rhythms are very slow. I just talk very slowly. That's one thing. And when I'm talking in public, I think I'm just very careful about what I say. This stems somewhat from, there's a real, you know, actors are often asked questions that they have no authority talking about. They're given in this culture particularly, people listen to them. And sometimes I don't feel comfortable talking. You know, I'm most articulate and I'm most expressive in the work. So somewhere deeply, the whole process of being a spokesman for the work, it can be very humiliating and very confusing. So I think I'm very careful. I don't want to be misunderstood, and I don't want to come off full of myself.
Not, I like the fact that you speak slowly. I mean, I think it's one of the things that makes you distinctive as an actor, and I almost got the feeling that you had to defend the way you talked. And I'm wondering whether you feel that you do.
Let's say, when I was a kid, I came from a large family, and people always got impatient with me to express what I needed to express. So people whose rhythms are much faster, yes, they do get impatient with you, and I am aware of that.
When you're working in a part, how much do you look at the rushes and watch yourself and then use that to go back to the character?
I never look at dailies. I never look at rushes.
Why not?
I think basically it's a bad idea. If you like what you see, it's not going to help you. If you don't like what you see, it's not going to help you. Acting's a confidence game on some level. And I don't think you can look at what you've done and then react to it. I think you start to craft a performance too much. I still have a very romantic view of performing in the respect that I like the idea of sending it out there. And people are going to, particularly in film, people are going to, there are people that fool with what you put out there and they turn it into something else. So I'd rather just let it out there in the purest kind of energy and not worry so much about effect. And once I think you see what you've done and you react to it, then you have much, you don't have as clear a line to doing what you're doing.
So what
does that make sense?
It does, and it makes me want to ask you, so what do you like to direct?
Hopefully a dream.
but if you're operating and out of this character that's somehow contained inside yourself and you don't want to look at the dailies to get you off track, what then do you want from a director?
To get a good setup, to have them create a world that's complete. Basically that, and also to keep me on track. I think I gravitate towards very strong directors. Because I believe in submitting to their view. Me, I don't feel like I have anything in particular to convey. Where I feel most useful is being the agent of someone else's idea.
I'm speaking today on Fresh Air with actor Willem Dafoe, and he's appeared in a number of films, including Streets of Fire, To Live and Die in L.A., The Last Temptation of Christ, Mississippi Burning, Born on the 4th of July, and Wild at Heart. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest today on Fresh Air is actor Willem Dafoe. What made you want to get into movies? And was there a feeling that the stage was not enough for you?
Basically, I'm lucky, and I don't have that classic actor's thing where I was knocking on doors. I was working with the Wooster Group, and I wasn't really actively soliciting film work. Someone saw me at the theater, and they asked me to be in this feature, low-budget feature called The Loveless, and that was my first film, and I really liked doing it. A woman out in California saw the film, called me up. She's a manager, and she said, would you like to do some more of this? Come with me.
Well, the first time I remember seeing you was in Walter Hill's film Streets of Fire,
mm-hmm.
which was, well, for lack of a better word, a kind of rock and roll fantasy adventure
mm-hmm.
movie. And you play a guy named Raven, who's
right.
head of this outlaw motorcycle gang.
Right.
Did you enjoy playing that part? Because he had such menace. And I thought you did it so well.
It was a lot of fun. There were a lot of things to play around with. I mean, motorcycles and... yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was very exotic, very playful. And with characters like that, where the mask is so strong, when they're so arch, you can really run with it. It was a very showy part.
Were you afraid that those were the kinds of roles you were going to keep getting?
Yeah, I mean, I like playing those roles, and I'll continue to play roles like that. It was just things that I was being offered were of a particular kind of thing. The activities were always the same. The guy always had a gun and said menacing things. And after a while, that becomes a little deadening. You feel yourself, you're drawing on the same parts of your imagination. It's not as much fun.
Did you have any hesitation playing Jesus Christ in Scorsese's Last Temptation of Christ?
No, not at all.
Really?
And when I look back on it, I'm quite shocked by that.
Right.
But it's true. It was like a timing thing. It was something that I had a real taste for.
When you were making The Last Temptation of Christ,
mm-hmm.
It was filmed in Morocco.
That's right.
What were the conditions like there?
Oh, very rough.
How so?
Morocco really doesn't have a film industry. This was a very low-budget movie. Everybody was working for scale. We didn't have a lot of money. When I say it was difficult, I just basically mean Morocco isn't terrifically developed, and we were shooting in rural areas, so it was very rough sometimes.
Do you think that had an effect on the performances?
Oh, sure. Sure, it worked on you physically, and also defined the place that we were making the movie very specifically. Let's put it this way: there weren't trailers around. Okay.
Gotcha.
So, when we had a break, it was like, find a tent if you were lucky.
So, did you feel more like Jesus?
I don't know what that is. I mean, I always make the distinction that I was playing this particular character in a screenplay based on a Katsantzakis novel, and this character's name was Jesus, and he does certain things in the story that remind us of another character named Jesus. As far as me playing Jesus, I don't know what that's about.
Well, what did you make of the reaction to the film and the picketing of theaters and the very strong criticism that it was, that it portrayed Jesus in the most defamatory way?
It was disturbing to me, and I didn't anticipate it. Very disturbing.
Yeah.
And the truth is, it's a film that I like a great deal, and the truth is, even today, it's in video stores, for example, there are whole chains that refuse to carry it, and they refuse to carry it just because the money that they'll make on it isn't worth the problems that certain groups may give them about carrying it. So. And also, when it opened, there were places in this country where the film would not be shown because a small group more or less threatened the theater owners.
You have stayed with the Worcester Group, I assume for some actors, once they start playing in movies, they kind of shut the door on that part of theater. Why have you stayed with the Worcester Group?
Because the work's great, and these are people that inspire me, and I really love performing with.
You have a child with Elizabeth Lecomp, who's also with the Worcester Group.
The director.
She's the director, that's
yeah.
Right. What is it like when she directs you?
Hell.
Really? Hell?
No, it's difficult. It's difficult. It's very easy to take things personally. And she's very tough.
Mm.
She's not, she doesn't coddle me at all. She makes me face things that I sure as hell don't want to face sometimes. She always keeps me a little off balance. And there's a part of me and a part of a lot of actors that has a controlling side as a protection. Well, she's very good at keeping things fresh, and she's very good at always having a little chaos and a little question in everything that you do. And as thrilling as that is, and as exciting as it makes the work, sometimes as an actor, it can be downright annoying. But that's, but I recognize that's my failing, not hers.
So is it hard to go home after a hellish day on the set or on the theater?
No, it's not hard. I mean, the line between work and life gets very fuzzy.
Yeah.
I'd say the only difficult part is, you know, you're both working on something, and it's very hard to get away because you have mutual concerns if something is going poorly or if you have a worry about the theater or, you know, there's no one to run home to cry to because you both have the same problems.
Well, it's been a real pleasure talking with you, and I thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air. It was a real treat.
Great. My pleasure.
Actor Willem Dafoe, he's in the new movie, Body of Evidence. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us about the news today. Noah, what stories do you have for us?
Hi, Marty. Ted Clark reviews the dilemma faced by the U.S. as it tries to formulate a policy about what to do in Bosnia, about the fighting there and the new fighting in Croatia. Linda Wertheimer talks with Congressman Lee Hamilton of Indiana, who says the Clinton administration should support the plan that Cyrus Vance and Lord David Owen have been trying to negotiate in Geneva. Ina Jaffe reports from Los Angeles, where, for many, there remains a great deal of apprehension about the police department. Also, letters from listeners, lots of mail about the efforts to lift the ban on gays in the U.S. military.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tomorrow night, NBC is presenting the season finale of I'll Fly Away. This dramatic series is in its second season and probably its last. TV critic David Bianculli expects NBC to cancel the series, but for now, David's in a heavy state of denial.
Maybe you haven't heard that music before. Apparently, a lot of people haven't, because I'll Fly Away is way down there in the ratings pile. Last week, it was ranked 85th out of 97 shows. But that's the theme music to I'll Fly Away, and the theme of today's sermon is a simple prayer that I'll Fly Away won't fly away. Let's put things in perspective here. It's not that TV audiences won't sit still for quality shows. Roseanne and Cheers and 60 Minutes are all in the top 10. And even such quirky acquired tastes as Northern Exposure are doing well. But an awful lot of how a show does in the ratings depends on where it's placed and how it's promoted. Seinfeld is going to get a lot more viewers tonight when it starts following Cheers than it did when it was up against ABC's Home Improvement on Wednesdays. I'll Fly Away on Friday nights has had real problems attracting an audience. One reason is the fact that it's an ongoing serial-type drama, and those don't do well on weekends. Just ask the makers of China Beach or Twin Peaks. I'll Fly Away is set in the 50s in the Deep South and explores the civil rights movement through the eyes of a white lawyer and his African-American housekeeper. Sam Waterston and Regina Taylor star, and their characters and those of their friends and families have been through more changes already in the short two seasons of I'll Fly Away than most TV characters do in their fictitious lifetimes. They've changed jobs and allegiances, they've lost loved ones and gained self-respect, and the changes have come slowly as the characters reassess their relationships, their goals, and their prejudices. And scenes like this one, where a judge imposes some harsh sentences on black high school kids who staged a peaceful demonstration, are anything but dated at a time when we're dealing with the racial ramifications of Rodney King and Marge Schott.
The citizens of Breland County have a right to live in a peaceable manner. When that peace is disturbed and continues to be disturbed in flagrant disregard for repeated requests by authorities to cease and vacate private property, it becomes an insult of a grievous nature to the community and is deserving of punishment to the full extent of the law. In the matter of Robert Evans, you are sentenced to 180 days in Breland County Juvenile Hall. Damon Hollins, who at the time of arrest was 18, is sentenced to 1 year in the state prison. That's enough of that. Any more comment, you'll find yourself spending the night in my jail, yeah?
I'll Fly Away is too good to lose. But even Don Ohlmeyer, the guy who became NBC's newest programming executive this week, has sort of dismissed I'll Fly Away as a 12-share show, referring to its low audience share. Well, here are two things for Don Ohlmeyer to keep in mind. One is that the one-hour drama series is becoming an endangered species, with news magazines taking over instead. 48 Hours beats Law & Order, Primetime Live beats L.A. Law, Maria Shriver beats Civil Wars last week, and 2020 trounces both Picket Fences and I'll Fly Away. So expectations ought to be a little lower. The other thing is, it ought to be the job of TV's producers to make the best shows possible and of the networks to find a way to bring audiences to them. A decade ago, that partnership worked at NBC with such shows as Hill Street Blues and Cheers, which took years to build an audience. In the 90s, the makers of I'll Fly Away have done their part. Now, it's NBC's turn.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post and author of Teleliteracy, Taking Television Seriously. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Chris McMahon. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, physicist Steven Weinberg tells us about looking beyond Einstein for the final theory and how smashing protons in the super collider may tell us why the grass is green. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.